Blog Talk Radio.
I'm just saying, anywhere else I can take, is it my destiny to live a life of prostitute? I'm just saying, where I see love, she sees a friend. What will it take for her to be the man behind the curtain and fight for me? I'm just saying,
welcome to another edition of Archivist Bets on Sexy Witches, a podcast from the Geek Girls perspective, and I am the head huntress, and this is our final season of this show, 10 to go out on, just like Ken. But there's still going to be plenty of content, and today is one of those days where we have a fuck ton of content to get through. So that was I'm Just Ken, and clearly we're going to talk about the Oscars, but we're going to do that in the second half hour of, so in about 30-so minutes from now. But first, we have another order of business. I have to introduce my sexy witches and talk about the icon, Stig! Commentator himself, the Dirty Southern Sorcerer, and he and I are going to start this hour with our adventures at AEW Revolution and the retirement of Sting. Please welcome to the show the son of celluloid himself, the voice of violence, Nathan Hamilton. How you doing, sir?
Hello, ladies, gentlemen, and everything in between. I am still alive and kicking despite the universe's best efforts to the contrary.
Excellent, sir. You sound like you're in a tunnel. You might want to fix that, but we're really glad you're here.
Fair enough.
Okay, we'll be right back because he's not the only person, and we're not just talking about Sting and the Oscars. In the second hour, the crazy warlock of Orange County is going to bring his horde of minions, of Daleks, to talk about Doctor Who for the next hour. It's a fandom we have not covered very much on Sexy Witches, and one of it that we've both been part of for most of our lives. So please, welcome to the show, the Warlock of Orange County, my partner in crime and convention. Please welcome to the show, Aaron the Cuz Kogan. How you doing? You're on with the Sexy Witches.
I am doing great. I am pumped for this show.
Yeah, we have a lot of people that wanted to call in. I mean, a lot of people that wanted to call in. So we're going to talk about wrestling for this first half hour. So please listen, and you're welcome to ask questions and stuff. It was, and then the next half hour, we're going to just talk briefly about our Oscar experience because, you know, enough people talk about it. We can give it like half an hour of our own opinions. But that's all I really want to give it. Even though I will say overall, I didn't hate the show. But I didn't love it either. But anyway, excuse me while I cough. I'm a little bit under the weather here. But we'll talk about that in half an hour. So I will be right back with you and go back over to Nathan and search and destroy. Where are you? I don't see you.
I am right here.
You're still in the cave. Okay. That sounds a little better.
Is that any better?
A little better.
Much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm basically deep-throating the microphone at this point, but...
Oh, well, you know.
I'm doing okay with that.
There's a visual.
Whoa, phrasing.
I know what I said.
So, we actually... Let me start it out with Nathan and lead into why we went to Revolution. After last year, on my birthday at AEW, we were in the second row, at the Go Home show right before All in England. And I actually at that point was like, you know what? I'm good with AEW. I've seen them 4 times now. I'm happy. I've gotten as close as I want to get to Sting and Omega and the Bucks and CM Punk. That was his second to last show with AEW. It was actually kind of a big deal. But then Sting announces that he's retiring. And I'm like, oh. And then they said the Greensboro Coliseum. And I looked at Nathan, who I know has a connection with Sting because he's from the Atlanta area originally, and go, we have to go. And I will take that bit from there. How bad and how important was it for you, Nathan, to see Sting in his retirement match?
Man, it really was a very full circle moment. Sting was on the first wrestling show I ever went to. Throughout the literal hundreds of wrestling shows I've been to since, Sting is probably the wrestler I have seen wrestle the most times. I remember I've always been the kind of wrestling fan that I've been a heel fan, meaning I root for the bad guys, unless they were wrestling Sting. Then fuck those guys. So it was, you know, Ric Flair is the coolest man on earth, unless he's fighting Sting, then he can go to hell. But so Sting had always been one of my guys, and he's really, if you think about it, for fans of my generation, he's really the last legend left. Like, all of the legends from that era are gone. Sting was the only one still going. And then you get into the next generation, which is your Steve Austins and your Rocks and all those guys. But for the generation that came up on what they call the Golden Age, you know, the Hulk Hogan and the, you know, Macho Man and Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen and all that, he was really the last one hanging on and fully earned the name The Icon. And that's right. Did it with someone else?
I heard Aaron giggling.
Oh, okay.
I was laughing, sorry.
Basically, like, he was, I never made the journey to the Greensboro Coliseum, which is like, it's one of those legendary wrestling venues like Madison Square Garden or the Cow Palace or the Sportatorium in Dallas or some of those places that are famous for historical events. And this was the site of the match that basically made Sting a star, when he had a 45-minute draw with Ric Flair for the title on Clash of the Champions, which, interestingly enough, that was the NWA's play against WrestleMania. WrestleMania was was on pay-per-view. So they said, we're going to put on a WrestleMania event, you know, level card for free on TBS. And they actually outdrew WrestleMania as far as viewers go that first time. Then, of course, there was maneuverings next day. But anyway, Sting being the final icon and in a building that I'd always wanted to go to but never got to, we decided, yeah, we got to go make that pilgrimage. And, oh, my God, I'm glad we did, because it was probably the best card that AEW's ever put on as far as wrestling, just in the ring product. But the atmosphere in that place was insane. Like, the energy of that crowd, like, it was... Yeah, and there was everyone from, like, so many kids with their faces painted up like Sting to, like, old people there that, you know, had been there. Like, they were my age when they went and saw Sting there for the first time in 1988. Yeah.
there were so many variants, Aaron. Like, the cosplay was choice at this event, which, you know, you always
That's
see people
so cool.
dressing up. I dress up as uh-huh. Orange Cassidy when I go a lot. And I did this time, but kind of loosely. There were every type of variant of Sting. And believe me, there's like 20 or 30 variants of Sting out there.
Over a 40-year career, you know, you change your look a lot.
I saw Darcy
the Mail Girl had dressed up as Sting.
Yes.
Nice.
Everyone is dressing up like Sting. It was like so many Stings. Every once in a while, you would see a Ric Flair. Woo! And one of the fun things was while we were waiting, because we were tailgating in the parking lot while we were waiting for the show to start, you could actually occasionally go, woo! And you could actually get a woo started in the audience. Even before you got in.
That's awesome.
It would echo all over in every direction. It was so cool. And that audience was absolutely pumped for this show.
And me being the absolute wrestling nerd I am, we were sitting there tailgating, and people be walking by, and I'm like, that's 1988 Great American Bash Sting. That's the thing from when he won the title from Hogan in 97. It was the deep dives and detail some of these people put into their costumes was phenomenal. The two favorite things I saw, there was one, it was the family of dad, mom, three kids, all dressed up like Stings from different era of his career. And it was the most, one of the most adorable things I saw was, who was it that the Fuck You chant was directed at? Christian, right?
No, it was Christian, yeah. No, it was Bucks. Fuck you, Young Bucks. That's what it was.
The Young Bucks. At one point, 19,000 to 22,000, depending on whose numbers you believe, were all chanting, Fuck you, Young Bucks, because that's who was taking on Sting in this tournament. And you could see this kid just look up at his dad, and dad goes, no. No, you can't chant that. But the other, probably my favorite cosplay, just because of how it looked. There was this girl who was probably, if she was a teenager, maybe, like 12, maybe 13, whatever. And she had this jacket that she had obviously hand-painted the scorpion on the back.
Oh, yeah. It was gorgeous.
And she had tassels on the sleeves that she'd obviously taken off of her bicycle. And attached to and it was obviously homemade, but there was so much love in this homemade costume that even the ones that look perfect, spot on, those are cool. But that little girl with that jacket was my favorite cosplay I saw that whole show.
It was absolutely, there were other people dressed, mostly Stings, but you saw like I said, Ric Flair's. And there was plenty of Orange Cassidy's because that's an easy costume and everyone loves Orange Cassidy. And there's a lot of times that said that Be My Father, which is Christian Cage's current thing where he's trying to adopt everybody's dead, anybody that has a dead father, he's trying to adopt right now. That's his gimmick. And so we almost came with signs. And even though it's terrible, I was like, my dad's dead, so is mine.
It all grew out of his first major feud after he turned heel was with Jack Perry, who was Luke Perry's son. And he kept getting close to it. He would get close to it for like a month and be like, they're not going to go into his dead dad. That would be in horrible taste. And then he just goes straight head first into it. And somehow the crowd just loved it because it was so bad. Couldn't believe he went there. So now every time he's getting into a program with with a wrestler, and they know his dad's dead, the crowd just waits for him to say it. It's the best really bad taste joke going in the business. It's awesome.
Wow.
This show was really like a passing of the torch. It felt like, even though normally when you do a retirement match, and we'll get into some of the details of the match itself in a few minutes, but when you do a retirement match, you're supposed to end staring at the lights, right? You send the young person over on you, and you move off into the sunset, dropping the belt. That's not what happened here.
No.
Spoiler alert. Sting maintained the belt and retired a champion 29-0. It didn't feel like he was overing an individual. It felt like he was passing the torch to a new generation of wrestlers. And that was kind of neat to feel that way. And the whole card was banging from beginning to end. Excuse me.
Don't die.
I'm still in the weather. Some of the highlights, one was there was supposed to be what they called Meat Match Madness, which we have no idea what that was actually going to be, but it was going to be a Hoss fight of some kind.
A few months ago, there was a match between Miro and Powerhouse Hobbs, who are two, jacked up 300-pound monsters. And it came out of one of the major wrestling commentators talking about it being big, beefy boys slapping meat. And so the crowd now, every time there's two big, beefy boys in there, just chant, Meat. And then they hit each other. Like, there's the fight forever chant, and they'll be earning that meat forever. And this is awesome because this is meaty, or meat is awesome. It's great.
Completely organic, like this whole chant
started. As a Phantom of the Paradise fan, I approve wholeheartedly.
So they did this 8-man instead. So they had 4 scrawny guys and then 4 big beefy guys, and everyone knew who was going to win. It was Wardlow. It was already destined to be. But every time the 4 big dudes were in the ring together, it was just like, oh, meat, oh, meat.
And then there was one point in the match. There was one point in the match where all the big dudes had gotten knocked out of the match. It was the 4 smaller dudes, and the crowd starts a "Where's the beef?" chant.
Yep, and there was, and it was also a chicken nuggets chant too.
Yep. I always say, if I'm, actually, I'm gonna go ahead and put them over. Bastards of the Universe is a stream that I'm guesting on every Thursday this month. And it's leading up to WrestleMania at the beginning of next month. And our whole thing is we're showing matches that you would show to a non-wrestling fan to try and get them into it. And I made the point, the way to get a non-wrestling fan into wrestling is not to show them matches, it's to take them to a show. Because if you were in that crowd, and we were there with someone who is surprisingly knowledgeable about wrestling, but is not a diehard fan. But by the end of it, she was like caught up in the energy and just cheering and just really getting into the show, and just commented afterwards how much she enjoyed it because of the crowd energy. So even if you don't give half a shit about wrestling like we're talking about, go for the crowd. Like, you get caught up in the excitement. It's like going to a major sporting event where every team is the home team, I guess.
It's also like a carnival show where they're telling the story through fight scenes. It's kind of amazing. And so there was not a lull, I would say, but there was a couple of matches in the middle where the crowd kind of mellowed out, went to go get drinks. Unfortunately, one of those was a title match with Tony Storm and Diago Perrazzo, which was really good, but everyone was kind of like, you know, it was a long show. AEW shows always are. And then Will
with
Ospreay
the pre-show, it was almost 5 hours with the pre-show.
Wow.
And it was hot in that building.
It was warm in there. But you know, at this point, people, and then all of a sudden, Will Ospreay walks out. And it was just huge. Will Ospreay was one of the biggest wrestlers in New Japan Pro Wrestling. He's originally from England and started in Revolution Pro Wrestling, Rev Pro for short. Is that correct, sir? I believe that is,
yes,
right?
Is.
Yeah, and then he went over to New Japan. He was a member of the United Empire, which was the opposite faction of Bullet Club. So they had a major feud, and if you know anything about Bullet Club it's a big deal to have a major feud. Matter of fact, the very last match he did with New Japan Pro Wrestling before he came over was United Empire versus Bullet Club in a steel cage match, and Will Ospreay went out looking at the lights.
This guy has a legit claim to being, say, if not, a lot of people consider him the best wrestler in the world. If he's not, he's at least in the top 5.
Yeah, he's a big deal
for AEW to sign this guy, and this was his debut.
Listen to our best of shows, you'll notice that Will Ospreay comes up a lot last year as well. He had an amazing year last year. After an injury where almost took him completely out, almost killed him. He broke his neck, I believe, if I remember right. It was pretty terrible. But he's back with a vengeance, and, you know, they're lacking a superstar because Kenny Omega is currently very sick and going through some major, major recovery right now. So he's like a welcome.
This is no joke.
Ospreay is going to be wonderful and fill that niche until we get Omega back. And the match that he did with Takeshita, who, by the way, even though Takeshita is from Japanese pro wrestling, he actually never, like, he was different promotion. I believe he was in All Japan or DDT.
He was in DDT, yes.
He was
so
in
their
DDT.
Paths never crossed. Their paths never crossed in Japan. No. It took them both coming to AEW to finally get the dream match between
That's
those
funny.
Two.
And it was glorious.
I know it's
like
I know it's
so
early
pretty.
And it's early in the year, but that match is currently sitting at my number two on matches of the year, and I will be shocked if it's not in my top five by the end of the year. Like the crowd 4 hours into a show in an oven, like
just went
insane.
Nuts. It was worth every moment. It was everything I could have hoped for. Like, I've been a major fan of Will Ospreay since 2019, before his major injury, and I was so excited when he came back and to see how much love he's getting. And you
he's
know,
almost he's almost like watching someone from a martial arts movie, because he's like the most violent gymnast you've ever seen. Like, he's pulling off these moves.
Oh my god!
Like,
can you?
How in the hell does, like, physics don't work that way?
Can you imagine him
as a
mid-80s canon-level action star? I could totally see
him. Oh, God, he'd be killing it.
Yeah, you know, not necessarily
he's
a good guy either.
Yeah, he's a once-in-a-generation athlete.
So we get that match, which was a banger. Then we get the world title match between Swerve, Hangman, and Samoa Joe. Swerve Strickland is one of their hottest commodities in wrestling as well. Like, him and Will Ospreay at some point will meet. It'll happen, and I can't wait for that. But in the meantime, he's chasing the world title, and it was a three-way. It was good. It was a very solid match, but after that was over, we all promptly forgot about it because
it had the inevitable job of being in between a match of the year contender with Ospreay and Takeshita and Sting's final match, which is a terrible spot to be in. But
especially with wrestlers of that caliber, it was really good. And Samoa Joe retained the title. And I asked Nathan today, I go, it doesn't do your heart good to hear that many people yelling their love for Samoa Joe. And he's like, yes, it does. You know,
because that dude, what I love about him, he toiled away on the indie circuit for literal decades. And then went to the WWE, was hot for a second, got hurt, and ended up on commentary for a while, and then just left because they just wouldn't let him wrestle. And now he's back, and he's a world champion, and the crowd is all kinds of into him, and he 100% deserves every bit of the shine he's getting right now.
And then the song Seek and Destroy starts. Go ahead and talk about the video. Yeah.
Let me set how they set this stage, because the way wrestling is not all just, you know, grown men in their underwear pretending to fight over a belt. It's the spectacle. So we sit there, and Justin Roberts, the Dapper Yapper, who I will give kudos as the best ring announcer in the business right now, comes out and says, "This next match is your main event of the evening." Arena goes black. All the lights cut out. And on the screen, you see the marquee of a movie theater. And it's the Plaza Theater in Atlanta, our home away from home, our beautiful movie palace here. And we're just so happy to see our theater. And they show Sting going in and sitting down in this beautiful movie palace and watching highlights from his career. And his whole, you know, catchphrase is, "It's showtime, folks." And so he looks into the camera and goes, "It's showtime for the last time. Let's do this." And then it goes black. So then, as, like, the lightning effects come out, his Sting's sons walk out and flank the stage, one dressed in the actual coat and tights he wore at the 1988 Great American Bash, one in his actual NWA Wolfpack outfit. And then they have not used Seek and Destroy by Metallica ever in AEW.
No. Mm.
But that was his WCW theme when he came out. That was, you know, for decades, that was when you heard that ban-an, ban-an intro, like, that it was time to go nuts because Sting was coming out. But we've never heard it. And then, boom, Sing and Destroy hits. And the place shook from that ovation. It was crazy.
Wow.
It was like they did an incredible job of creating that moment.
Because
there are certain indelible moments, that will always be one of them.
And right before that, they introduced two guests. One was Ric Flair, who he wrestled, you know, all those days in 1988 in that arena.
And he's wrestled 1,000 times.
Yeah, so he's at at ringside, and then Ricky the Dragon Steamboat was the special timekeeper for this match, which is a way huge name. And while that was happening, all these famous wrestlers that are retired, some of them got special permission to be there, it turns out, because they have legacy contracts with WWE. So that was kind of cool that they got permission to go. But we saw Lex Luger get snuck in. We saw Diamond Dallas Page get snuck in. And
our yoga instructor.
Yeah, he is our yoga. We actually do his yoga. And then you saw a few other people that
Magnum TA was there, Nikita Koloff, Arn Anderson. Like, a lot of the names you'd recognize from, like, back in Sting's heyday were all there. But what was cool is they didn't make a big deal about it. They were kind of just sat at ringside, and they kind of showed them in a passing shot, but they didn't make it was very classy the way they acknowledged them without exploiting the fact that they were there.
Nice.
And so all that was going on, and then the match starts, and it's a pretty solid match, but there, and we won't go into everything because there's plenty of
mentioned
channels. I was leading to that, Nathan.
Oh, okay.
I was going with it. So, it's a tag team match with the Young Bucks. Fuck the Young Bucks. And Darby Allin, who's been a AEW staple from day one. He's also one of the longest running baby faces on the show.
He's a legit fucking lunatic.
He is. He's about to literally go climb Mount Everest in 2 weeks.
He has a match tonight, and then he's literally taking a couple of months off to go climb Mount Everest.
Yeah.
What?
He even made a promo on TV last week where he says that, you know, he may not come back, and if I die on the mountain, I love y'all. He actually said that. Motherfucker. Made of rubber. I've seen him take some terrible bumps and just come right back up. He's never been injured for long periods of time, just here and there, and he's always, you know, he's just been around forever. He did the absolute, he honored Sting immensely through this whole match, and then he did the scariest bump I've ever seen not in a death match. And they took a ladder, they put it on the stage, or on the ring. It was like, what, a 15-foot ladder?
I see, from where he fell off it, because it was sitting on the ring, to where he eventually fell at somewhere between 15 and 20 feet.
Yeah, because he was at the top of it. He dropped off of it into, get this, a bunch of folding chairs with a plane of shower glass door on it. And he fell straight into it.
And it exploded, and they just showed on the screen him like lying face down after taking the bump, and you literally could just watch his back open up.
Yeah, like the blood just started rising, and it was you know, all surface scratches. He actually hit that bump absolutely perfectly. It was a perfect bump, but the blood and the audience, and later on he climbed up on the third rope, and the camera got really close, and so the camera showed the injury. And you could hear the entire 17,000 people in that audience gasp at once. It was amazing. What was funny,
that bump was on the opposite side of the ring from where we were sitting, so we couldn't see him land.
No.
So all we heard... We saw him disappeared on the other side of the ring, glass fly everywhere, and we didn't see Darby for another 10 minutes. It was just Sting. It was just Sting from on out, and we were just kind of like, is he dead? Like, did they carry him out and we didn't notice while Sting was fighting the Young Bucks in there? Like, we legit thought, like, he might just be gone. But they used that to write him out of the match and let Sting take center stage for the rest of the match, which is a perfect way to book someone's farewell.
And he's getting his ass kicked. He's kicking their asses. They move the ladder. He does a table bump, completely no-sells it, where he falls right into the table and comes right back up. He gets super kicked in the face. He gets thrown through another piece of glass. This is a 60-year-old man.
Really 60?
60. He is 60. Yes, that's why he's retiring.
He's 64, actually. He's 64. Oh, and he's doing all this. That's a 64-year-old man doing all this shit.
And then they do a callback to when Ric Flair retired, and they kicked him in the face, and they're about to take him over. And at the last minute, Darby saves him, and then Sting gets the over, and everyone goes absolutely nuts because he won.
This is one of the reasons I love AEW, is they love giving Easter eggs to longtime hardcore fans. Ric Flair's retirement match, it was one of the most emotional moments in wrestling ever. Like, he's bawling his eyes out, knowing the match is about to end. And Shawn Michaels has hit him with everything he's got, and he gets up one last time, puts his dukes up, and says, "Come on, motherfucker." And Shawn looks at him and says, "I'm sorry, I love you," kicks him in the face and pins him. So the Bucks, being the dastardly heels, Santa and Sting gets up on it, gets up after the bump and makes the motion, you know, "Come at me, bro." And they both look at him, and one goes, "I'm not sorry, and I hate you," right before they kick him in the face.
Yeah.
No one caught it, really, when they were watching, but watching it on, when going back and watching it on TV, like, that's a cool Easter egg for the ones who know, and the ones who don't, it just seems like some, an asshole would say. But it's those little nods to the history of AEW that's one of the reasons that makes it, I think, appeal more to the hardcore fan than WWE sometimes.
And, of course, at the end, as Sting's giving his farewell speech, the entire backstage comes out, wrestlers, everybody, and all bawling their eyes out, especially Dax from FTR. I mean, you could physically see him crying from across the friggin' stadium. It was pretty funny.
Wow.
I've never seen that many grown men crying in one place at the same time ever.
It was everything it should have been. And it might have been one of the best retirements in wrestling. And I think it's going to go down in history. And it might have just – AEW has been slumping lately. I think this might have turned it around. So I'm looking forward to the future. And now that we have and Sting is left us in a really good place. So now we have to
talk.
Yeah,
thank you, Sting, for all those years. It was great. And it turns out one of the best moments that we saw this last week on the Academy Awards also came courtesy of a wrestler. So.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
I was going to say, you had mentioned that they're wrestling in their shorts, but John Cena said they wrestle in their jorts.
Which is worse than being naked.
He is known for wearing jorts.
That's worse than being naked. That was like the only time Jimmy Kimmel was funny, that whole show, I think.
Agree with you.
He was kind of terrible. But so we're going
to
when
he said that Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie already won the award that counts, and that was the genetic lottery. That was his best time the whole time.
There were other jokes, but
I hate to disagree with y'all, but when he read the former guy's tweet or truth and then replied to it, "I'm surprised you're still up. Isn't it past your jail time?" That was fucking awesome.
Well, that was funny. They did read that fly. There was a couple of times. Let's now we're going to leave wrestling behind and talk about the Oscars for a few minutes. And, but honestly, there's a lot of the biggest win of the night, the biggest thing that could possibly happen physically, was that after 70 years and 38 movies, we finally have an Oscar for God motherfucking Godzilla. And
yes.
I couldn't be more excited. Long live the king.
Hey, everyone. Oren signing in.
Hi, I have someone calling in on the line. I believe this is a regular caller. His name is Oren. How you doing, sir? He has a talk. How you doing, sir?
Pretty solid.
All right, cool. So we are going to talk about the Oscars for about 25 minutes here. And then we're going to move on to Doctor Who, which will be an interesting conversation. And Gallifrey 1, which is the convention in Los Angeles. But Godzilla 1... And if you want to read the speech, it was very hard to understand on the film, but it was excellent speech that he gave on the show. But they all had variants of Godzilla, and they were wearing shoes with Godzilla heels.
So good.
It was so good, right? So
he was kind of hard to understand in that speech. I mean, kudos for making a speech in something that's not your native language. You did way better than I could have done.
Yeah.
But I honestly think the best thing they could possibly do for any replays is to dub it very, very badly. Because it would be fitting for the Godzilla.
That's messed up and it's funny.
So... I do want to mention.
Why did it win for special effects over Oppenheimer? I'm curious.
It deserved it. It was beautiful. It looked exactly. It was $15 million and made all the other films look like chumps that were $200 million.
Did more
year.
With less.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer generally puts. I mean, Christopher Nolan generally like recreates stuff without CGI. So.
And I'm not taking anything away from Oppenheimer. I thought it was a pretty solid film and deserved most of the wins it got. But it didn't give me the warm, fuzzy feeling that Godzilla Minus One gave me watching it. And I saw that in the theater more than once. I absolutely adore it. Someone's breathing into their mic. Pull away, guys. I think it might be Oren. You're breathing
Darth
into
Vader.
Your mic too much. Yeah, Darth Vader, Oren. That was better. Thank you. But that moment was good. I do want to mention something about the John Cena moment. Sarah Trost just wrote me and reminded me about this. That moment was actually bought by a group called Naked Without Us, which is a pay equity organization. So that was actually a sponsored moment on the show.
Do we have a caller in an iron lung?
I that is definitely not me.
Oh, no, it is. As soon as you said something, it stopped.
Well, see? I'll say this is actually the first, I think of the, this might have been the first Oscar ceremony in about 12, maybe 14 years that I didn't watch. Except for the highlights, and then stretching back, it might have been one of only two in 20 years that I still haven't watched yet, so it was a little nice to take a break, but I mean, the most important thing is to know that some of my favorite things won. Like, for me, Robert Downey Jr. is big. I've always been a fan of him, even outside of the, you know, MCU, whatever. I never care about superhero movies, so...
Well, I love
Christopher
Robert
Nolan
Downey
winning.
And I love Chris Nolan, too, but it's like their wins were more for their body of work over time because, and not really the movie that they were in this year. Once again, it was a solid film, but there was other daring choices I think could have been awesome as for Oscar wins. I mean, really, Robert Downey Jr. finally has one, but he doesn't really need the justification. You know what I'm saying? He's fucking Robert Downey Jr.
Well, I think he really, really wants to stop being known as Iron Man, and he had a whole body of great movies before 2008, so I think it's a good reminder that he's great, yeah.
My favorite performance of his is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, hands down. Love that movie.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, Val Kilmer is also my favorite. That's actually one of my favorite performances of him, too.
And argue.
But the best, I actually thought as a show, Jimmy Kimmel was a terrible host, which is weird because he's done it before. I didn't find him funny at all.
I think it's very useful to change up the host every year. So I think there's a lot of great choices. I think they should take a risk on Kevin Hart or Eddie Murphy or Tiffany Haddish or I think
they
Tom Hanks could work really well.
Please not Kevin Hart.
It's a thankless job. I mean, the host of the Oscars. So I mean, I don't diss on Jimmy Kimmel because he wasn't good. It's really hard, and whoever was doing the writing on the show when the actors were writing their own material, it was actually pretty funny. But when they were using whatever the teleprompter was telling them, it was pretty generic.
The Chippendales bit was so painful.
Oh, that was the worst bit of the night.
Which
Although, one? There was a little bit where a couple of the presenters did a play on, we're like Chip and Dale. And the other presenters thought they said, Chippendales, the male erotic dancers. Get it? Not the chipmunks. The other thing that really pissed me off, and I'm not alone on this, was Kimmel's little joke about having the Academy members' kids fill out the animation portion.
And
it's 2022, guys.
He dug at it last time he was on there, too. I mean, come on,
guys.
I am
so sick of that shit. I mean, we put aside for a second that it's a lazy, dumb, trite subject. The equivalent of airline food jokes at the Academy. But on top of that, it wasn't even done well. And then the Academy to back it up with their little clip of the wonders of world animation does 95%, 98% Disney and Pixar.
Yeah.
Some family movies. Because I guess that's all animation is to Americans, which, God damn it, how many times do we have to say it? Animation is cinema.
Well, this was one of the few years where a non-Pixar, non-DreamWorks, I mean, film won in the animated category.
Yeah, but it's also Miyazaki, who's already won for Spirited Away. Not that I take anything away from Hayao Miyazaki, but they're not doing any variety. They're not going any daring. That Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles wasn't even nominated was kind of an oversight this year.
Why was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that artistically ambitious?
It was amazingly artistically ambitious. It was actually, I would say, it did everything that the new Spider-Verse movie did, but did it in a more exciting and cohesive way. You could follow the story better because there's so much overload. And I'm not taking away from Spider-Verse because I know Aaron loves that movie to death. It was nominated. It deserved its nomination. But I also think Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles should have been nominated.
Did we talk about the
style. It's beautiful.
Did we talk about the Annie Awards, the Animation Awards, on the show last time?
No, they hadn't come out yet.
Into the Spider-Verse and Blue Eye Samurai took everything between the two of them.
By the way, we did finally catch up with Blue Eye Samurai, and you were 100% right. That was awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you loved it. I'm so glad.
Oh, yeah. That's why I yelled peaches, because, you know, peaches. But I do want to put on something that I did like. I liked when they were giving the acting nominations, acting awards away, how they had the five previous winners all do a special speech for each of the individual nominees. I thought that was a really solid, good idea, and it gave everybody a moment. I really loved that. So I thought that did work.
You watched a lot of the nominees that were getting talked up by the previous winners. Like, you saw a lot of them get legit choked up during those.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would.
Absolutely.
It wasn't new, but it was, yeah, they do it. I mean, they do it like, it seems like they do it every 10 years or so.
I think like four or five, but yeah, your point is right.
But it,
yeah,
it's
but
totally...
it was.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
No,
I think they probably could stand to do it for the directing nominations, too.
Yeah, I agree with that. That would be good for the directing one. The win that made me the happiest, aside from Godzilla, was Emma Stone. Like, she deserved every bit of that award. She was awesome. And her speech was adorably off the cuff. Like, it was awesome. I enjoyed that win a lot.
And a lot of people are, like, pointing out Oppenheimer's 7 wins, but right behind him was, Poor Things with 4 wins.
Who saw that coming?
Really, really well. Yeah, I was very pleased that, Yorgos Lanthimos, for some reason, one of the weirdest directors on the planet, yet he's an Oscar darling. They love him.
Well, speaking of idiosyncratic directors who won, Wes Anderson actually won an Oscar. He's technically an Oscar winner now. He won in the short film category.
Any other interesting wins I'm trying to think of that were a surprise?
I think in the lead acting category, I feel like they're diluting the award a little bit by ignoring actors who have really good resumes for their whole careers, like Paul Giamatti or Bradley Cooper are both more impressive than Cillian Murphy. And this is a year after Brendan Fraser.
That's an opinion, dude. Cillian Murphy has been rocking it since he was 16.
Here.
A year after Brendan Fraser, George of the Jungle, whatever, beat Colin Farrell, and it just felt like, Rami Malek and Casey Affleck don't have amazing careers, and they won this award. So I just feel like if it's close, you might as well go for someone like Paul Giamatti or Bradley Cooper, who has a really good filmography.
I could list off all of Cillian Murphy. When the Stakes the Barley, Breakfast at Pluto. I can keep the girl with the pearl fucking earring, which is phenomenal.
Pearl earring was Colin Firth and Scarlett Johansson and Tom Wilkinson, right?
And Scarlett Johansson's boyfriend in that movie. It's one of his first films. Is Cillian Murphy? He's in that movie.
And for horror fans, 28 Days Later.
28 Days Later, which was his star-making role, it really did. It made him a star. He became a household name almost instantly for a zombie movie, right? I know it's an infection movie.
Quote unquote.
That's a different conversation. He also played I know you don't like comic books, Lauren, but he was actually in the first Batman.
He was a
Batman
great
film.
Dr. Crane's Scarecrow. Fuck yeah.
I like Batman Begins, obviously. That came from a decade in which the genre wasn't saturated. So I'm less likely to watch a comic book movie when there's 15 a year. But, in 2005, that was like it for comic book movies. So, of course, I enjoyed Batman Begins, and I liked his take on the part. Yeah, I think he's very good in Christopher Nolan movies. I'm not as familiar with him outside of Christopher Nolan's work. But
he
seems like a good point that he's been in a lot of stuff.
I would recommend Wind the Shakes the Barley, which is a historical drama about the IRA. It's amazing. And then Neil Jordan's Breakfast at Pluto is extremely boundary-breaking at the time.
So
I'd recommend both those films. I think you'd like them. And I think they both got nominated for writing Oscars, if I remember right.
Breakfast at Pluto.
Yeah, so definitely I would check those out if you want to see some of his earlier work. And I'm not taking it. If I had a choice other than Cillian Murphy, I would actually say Paul Giamatti should have won it. But, he's won it before, and I don't think that we'll see the last of him. You know what I'm saying?
Paul has never won. He was a bridesmaid once before, so.
Yeah. I have a feeling he will see Paul Giamatti in the front row of the Oscars again. But, you know, everything else was pretty obvious. I mean, you had, like, you know, I do agree with the editing win for Oppenheimer for a three-hour film. It doesn't – I didn't feel complete – I had to take it in two stints because it's so long, and but it didn't feel long. And to make – and this is also a shout-out to Nolan – making – nothing but hearings in rooms where you're reading transcripts interesting is really hard, and he pulled it off, so I'll give him that.
I do have one final question about one of the awards. What did you guys think, and I think we're all fans of Poor Things, but what did you think about it winning production design? I thought that some of it seemed a little overly CGI'd.
Well, it has low verisimilitude, so I kind of give it a pass on that. But I don't remember what it was against. I actually usually know this nomination by heart, and I don't. Who was the nominee for that?
Barbie was a big one. Also, I think Napoleon.
I was rooting for Barbie on production design, honestly. And I wanted it to win costumes.
But... you know, I'm not sad about seeing a genre like Poor Things and Godzilla.
Neither am I.
And, you know, fucking A.
Absolutely.
Anytime I see science fiction, fantasy, horror, animation getting acknowledged, hell yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you know, and even though Oppenheimer won cinematography, there was a vampire movie nominated for Best Cinematography this year.
Oh, Conde,
so
which is
a beautiful
movie.
And it's a really good movie, too. So, you know.
What movie was that?
Conde.
El Conde.
El Conde. It's about...
I think it's on Shudder right now.
Yeah.
I thought it was a Netflix original, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. Never mind.
I could be wrong, too. That's just me.
Orin, it's a fictionalized version of the end of Augusto Pinochet's life where he's a vampire. It's
very
really
interesting.
Cool.
The Chilean dictator.
Mm-hmm. You probably would like it. It's on Netflix, by the way. I had to double check that.
Oh, so. Netflix. Nice.
Yeah.
I will definitely look at it. Thanks so much, everyone. I think it was a great year at the Oscars, too. Have a good night.
Have a good night. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us.
Good night. So, he always says something controversial. This time it was about Cillian Murphy, and I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. No. Cillian Murphy earned his Oscar. I actually think he did. He actually played against type in Oppenheimer. So, you know, and he got to have a sex scene with Florence Pugh. Oh, my God. Like, that's a hot couple right there.
No doubt.
Oh, my God. It is one of his first films he gets to make out with Scarlett Johansson, and now he has to do sex scenes with Florence Pugh. What the hell, dude? Uh-huh. Someone has – people – and then he also dated some hot guys in movies, too, for that matter. So
I got to say, the best cameo –
Natalie thinks he's a hot guy.
Best cameo on the show?
Killian.
Slash.
And yeah.
That was so
like
good.
That performance,
I've watched
everyone
that
was
three
waiting.
Times now.
Everyone was waiting for that performance, and I'll be damned if it wasn't everything everyone was hoping for, man. That was an awesome production
really
number.
I really can't say anything.
And we were talking
about
earlier, kind of fuck Ryan Gosling. No one should ever be that perfect.
Yeah.
it's not fair to the rest of the human race.
I mean, he was saying you can be hot, you can be famous, and you can be talented, but you can't be all three, and he's all
and
three.
And
rich. And
rich.
Oh, yeah,
all of those things at once.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, and what's cool about Ryan Gosling is he's also kept his, like, even though he started as a Disney kid, he's kept a relatively strong indie cred through his career. Even doing Barbie is kind of an indie cred thing. You know, right? Like, everyone's, like, praising him like he was in Half Nelson, you know, which is where he was nominated the first time for an Oscar, by the way.
That one long, sustained note he hit at the very end, he was like, if there was any doubt, you're like, well, damn, dude can sing. That was impressive. Mm-hmm.
Everything about that moment. And you could tell when he starts the song that Margaret Robbie doesn't know he's behind her. You know, she gives that, like, laugh.
Yeah.
Like, oh, shit.
My guess, the way I think they probably set that up, they probably told Margot Robbie, we're going to set up a camera here so we can get a couple of reaction shots from you during the performance. And then he kind of snuck in behind her right before they started. Like, that's how I would have set that up, because she genuinely is, like, look, that is genuine surprise on her face. She's a great actress, but I don't think she could have pulled it off that well. That is genuinely, you know, a surprise. Oh, my God, this is an incredible look on her face. When that happened.
Yeah, no. I figure it was a mixed bag, but I think it was better than the last 2 years of Oscars, with the exception of the slap. We don't want to count this. The slap was like weird and on. I mean,
one other moment I want to bring up that was probably my second favorite moment of the entire show was Michael Keaton, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Danny DeVito.
Oh, yeah.
That was fun.
That was hilarious. And because Michael Keaton could have just sat there and kind of laughed and, you know, gone with, and,
yeah,
you know, ha, I made a good joke. But no, he played it perfectly. Stone faced.
Like,
yeah.
Come at me, bro.
Like,
come at me, bro.
That moment was played perfectly, and it was hilarious.
You know, in a superhero fight, Michael Keaton's going to win. He played Batman. He played Birdman and won an Oscar for that.
Yes, he did.
And then he's also played Vulture, so he could just kick Dr. Freeze's Penguin's butt. Yeah, I know. So we love Michael. And Annie was played Batman himself again this year, and it was the only good things about the Flash movie,
the Flash.
Right? So
you're right.
Yeah.
And to remind you all that we are, in fact, living in the darkest, dumbest timeline, we have Batman on film in Batgirl, but we'll never get to see it.
Yeah, we know.
Thanks, WB.
We know. There's so much bullshit. They're also deleting a bunch of licensed Comedy Central games off of streaming services, and people are pretty upset about that. Some that have developed communities for years. You know, and they're not giving the rights back to the indie people. So fuck Warner Brothers. We'll talk about that in the show. But last but not least, before we put this to bed, because it's almost time for Doctor Who.
You can say fuck the Warner Brothers, but the Warner sister dot I will still support.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
But is Al Pacino's final? Al Pacino gave out the Best Picture award to Oppenheimer, and he didn't even he just walked out. Said, I'm here to give the award. You know, I guess I got to open the envelope. Yeah, I read Oppenheimer.
Here we go.
And everyone was like, what? And then all of a sudden the orchestra goes, oh, cue. And they start playing the scene.
Hey, the show ended under time.
Five whole minutes.
We have two solid years in a row of the fucking weirdest presentation of Best Picture. I think I can make it a third. I really do. Give him the whole goddamn thing. He'll bring it in.
Let him host.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
That would be amazing.
Natalie says he can't do 3.5 hours of Nicolas Cage. No. Au contraire, mon cher. We're doing
I don't know,
film
I don't
festival
know if the world's ready for that.
Bring it.
Nick Cage.
Well, I don't know. We did 3 hours of Nicolas Cage. It was called Mandy.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love Mandy so much.
Me too.
I am Nicolas Cage's little bit, presenting Giamatti as one of the nominees was one of the highlights of the night for me.
Yeah, it was.
Would I wear
a contact lens? Of course I would. But that's not the. That was fucking Nick. Let Nick be Nick.
Yeah.
That's
all
I'm saying. Let Nick be Nick.
I
am 100% for him hosting the Oscars next year.
Yeah. Right.
100%.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that maybe next year they'll have casting director as a new award. And this year they gave a stunt montage, but they still don't have the balls to give a stunt coordinator Oscar. But maybe, just maybe, we'll get one of those.
Maybe the montage is a step in the right direction. We'll eventually see one.
Yeah.
But I would give it a B minus, maybe a B, a solid B show. I would give it
a solid B.
Yeah, a solid B. I would say that was fine. I'm really
excited. B for Barbenheimer.
Well, we are now at the 10 o'clock hour, so we are going to put the Oscars to bed for another year. Nathan, do you have some plugs or stuff you got to do? He's leaving us before we switch topics.
Okay.
So the floor is his.
I'm going to step out, but listen to me tomorrow night on the Bastards of the Universe stream. Join the Discord, and I think we're also streaming it on Twitch, if I am not mistaken. Saturday, if you are in the Atlanta area, come to Das Barbecue and come see Deep South Wrestling. We are doing a show then, and other than that, everybody, support indie wrestling, indie movies, indie music, and all independent art.
And him and I are going to do an in-depth preview on the 27th on this show of WrestleMania weekend, what we're going to do, because we're going to be there for that. We're not going to the big show, but we're going to several others. And we also will be talking about our previews of our adventures with the total eclipse of the sun in Niagara Falls. And that'll be on the 27th. That's Wednesday the 27th, so exactly 2 weeks from now. Thank you, Nathan. It was always a pleasure to have you on Sexy Witches. And
it's always a pleasure to be had.
Give some love to your buggy friends for me.
Will do. Everybody, have a great evening.
Good night now.
Good night.
All right. I'm going to start some music. And then so if you're on the line, hold on just a minute. I'm going to bring a bunch of people on, and then we're going to talk about Time Lords. This was actually in my jukebox because we had a rule that only one-hit wonders could be in our jukebox, so we had the 45 of it for a long time.
Nice.
So that was pretty cool.
I remember that from Dr. Demento days.
Hell yeah. We had quite a bit of Dr. Demento was very much represented in the jukebox. We also had Hello Dad, I'm in Jail. We had They're Coming to Take Me
Excellent.
Away. I could go on. We had an epic jukebox, and I still have a few of the pieces, but I didn't get all of it. I got a few of them out. But we are not talking about that. We are talking about Doctor Who, because about 2 weeks ago, there was a big convention, the Gallifrey one, which is the Los Angeles convention for Doctor Who. We also have up in Maryland a pretty good Doctor Who convention. But unfortunately, it is folded. And matter of fact, the hotel it is in has been closed and condemned, which is very, very sad. Because that was also where the Maryland Monster Mania was. So rest in peace. And my very first horror convention was in that building too. So so I'm very sad. I'm gonna miss that. But other than that, the Doctor Who has been in my life actually for a long time. My parents were huge science fiction nerds and PBS nerds on top of it. So a combination of the two, they pretty much watched Doctor Who a lot. Though My conscious memory is really starts with the Fourth Doctor, with Tom Baker, who I guess nostalgia-wise, but truly, he was my favorite, and he still is to this day. So, Aaron, I'm going to bring it to you because I'm going to hand the mic and the hosting to you. You have two guests on the line right now. Why don't you go ahead and introduce them and then ask them who their favorite Doctor is before we get into recapping Gallery Free, and we'll talk about Doctor Who in general because there's a brand new Doctor in town as well.
There is indeed. Mystery guest, won't you sign in, please? Who's on the line with us?
310, who is that?
That would be me. Hello, Neil Johnson on the line.
Yeah, I wonder who that could possibly be.
Yay! How, Neil, how you doing?
I'm constant vertical. How are you all?
Oh,
how about you, Jenny?
Favorite doctor, I'd have to say Capaldi. For the simple reason that the only way, by his own admission, you could distinguish Peter Capaldi's doctor from God, it's the eyebrows.
Very nice.
Jenny?
All right, 402 area code. Jenny?
Gosh, you would ask me. Oh, bloody hell.
Well, first off, who was your first doctor?
I tend to like... Oddly enough, my first doctor would be Mr. Davidson. That's who I remember. But I watched this since I was a kid. My dad really was the science fiction aficionado. So if Doctor Who, Blake Seven, Sapphire and Steel, all that stuff was on TV when I was a bit younger. So my new thing is whomever it is that's new at the moment, just because I'm kind of excited to see what they can do and, how the part's going to go and what future it holds. So right now I'd say it's Shuti Gatwa just because he's got so much energy.
Yeah. Indeed, and I like the suggestion that they're going to be shedding the 1,000-yard stare doctor and being mourning over Gallifrey for so many years, they'll get a fresh start with a new, exciting, bouncing off the walls doctor that seems to be more in line with Baker's doctor. All right, Tom Baker's doctor, because there's two Baker doctors.
True.
Hmm. Yeah, Tom Baker. There's Colin Baker, too, but we talked about Tom in particular. So,
go ahead. My first doctor as a kid was actually Jon Pertwee. And I caught just the tail end of him, and I could only watch Doctor Who when I went to visit Grandpa Isaac and Grandma Mary in Palos Verdes.
Oh,
down in Harbor City, we didn't get that channel. Kids, way, way back in the day, where you lived had a bearing on what TV you could watch. Ask your parents about it.
To be fair, it's the same these days in the radio. Where I live, near Palos Verdes, I can get the San Diego NPR loud and clear. Can't get Los Angeles to save my life.
That is so crazy.
That's actually so. You get to listen to my friend Beth Accomando. She does the film stuff for that station. So
excellent.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, my memory of Pertwee as a kid was he was a little scary and he had that stentorian Shakespearean thing. And he was always pretty pissed at somebody, usually humans, for wanting to be too violent. And then I went back and watched a few and he's dressed like some sort of Victorian fop. He's driving around in this silly, wonderful open air Bentley. And, I don't even know. When you're a kid, you just, things are weird. But then, Tom Baker quickly became my fave. And he became the yardstick that I compare all doctors by. But I kind of agree with Jenny. I'm a little bit fickle in that I kind of love whoever the current doctor is.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny you should mention these doctors being a fop, because I do believe in one episode when Hartnell's doctor encountered his two immediate successors, he referred to them as a dandy and a clown.
Lovely.
What appeal? What? I was going to ask our Grove, what is the appeal of Doctor Who? How does it, how come after all, especially in America, there was a couple of seasons that were made aimed at American audiences only because the Britons stopped watching it for a little while. But it is now, like, I would say the fandom is as big as any, especially once, you know, the modern era of Doctor Who kicked in. But what is the appeal of Doctor Who? Why has it endured so long?
I think part of the reason, I think there's two major reasons as to why it has endured. First of all, each episode is basically anthological, and like many other sci-fi shows, or even relatively other television shows, are basically morality tales. And whether they're the best thing ever written or you're wondering, oh dear God, who signed off on this, everybody loves a good morality tale, whether it's as simple as a good versus evil or a tough decision to make or something like that. And such a mindset in whether it's a play, radio show, TV show, whatever, it keeps the audience engaged and keeps them hungry. And second, when it comes down to it, the Doctor always has a companion or two or even more. And the companion is playing the part of the audience, like what's going on, what can I do, and all that kind of thing, while the Doctor is the hero of the piece. So we're able to relate very closely to the companions, because we're them, basically, and they're us.
That's really well said. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the companion is the person watching it on TV. It's your entrance into the show itself, so it allows you to vicariously live what they're going through when they travel through time. And I think time travel is always a big part too. Everyone wants to know what things could possibly hold. It's that ultimate what if, and what will tomorrow bring.
I've always been very partial to time travel stories as well, but he does more than that. He goes into alternate universes. I mean, it gets complicated with the Doctor here. But
that complication is offset by even the companions not quite understanding what's going on. So we as the audience feel validated that we don't necessarily need to know what's going on. Just as the Doctor knows what he's doing, the companion is trying to figure it out. So we're not drowned in technobabble, so to speak.
But you know, even the robots had attitude. I mean, like K-9 is a good example. He was kind of like to bring kids into the show, but he was always kind of snarky.
He was K-9.
You know, it's always a good thing. So they had. I always liked, especially I would say Chris Eccleston's maybe the exception, but most of the doctors have this like slight wink and sense of humor about their lives and what they're doing. And they seem to be having fun, even if they are not quite showing that they're having fun. Like, they're always like, you know, like Tom Baker's doctor was always so arrogant, but like so wonderfully arrogant, you know, and you wanted to root him on. You know, he was extremely likable, even in his pompousness, and that was wonderful. Chris Eccleston was one of my favorite doctors, though, but his doctor was so different than any of the others, because he was actually a doctor that was going through grief, and you don't see that very much.
Well, I feel like grief is kind of the background radiation of Doctor Who. He's always moving on. Leaving companions behind is something that has to happen. Death, even though we call it regeneration, is always a factor. I mean, you can't watch David Tennant's I Don't Want to Go and not, well, I can't anyway, watch it and not lose it. And then I don't know if it was with Capaldi or one of the earlier doctors, but the theme of you can't save them all. David Tennant. This is very much a David Tennant theme. I can't save them all. Fixed point in time, right? So,
right,
grief,
I mean, especially the Pompeii episode's really keen on that, that Donna even asked just to save one.
And then the one that really slays me
is fatalism on the part of the Doctor, particularly after when he believes Gallifrey was destroyed by his hand.
Yes.
Now, speaking of Gallifrey, you both had attended Gallifrey 1, Can you talk about it a little bit?
Sure.
Well, yeah. Jenny, ladies first.
No, go ahead, Nan.
All right. Well, before I get into Gallifrey itself, I remember the previous convention, there was rumors floating about be sure to get your ticket early because they're going to have a very, very big guest, and speculation was rife over it.
Yeah.
And some of us dared to hope that it might be David Tennant showing up. But when Derek Jacobi came and I said he was coming, my wife and I were just absolutely thrilled, couldn't wait to go to the convention to sit down for the interview, because particularly actors with his level of experience and being around the block so often, they always have the best stories. So that was always the best thing, and he did not disappoint. Although I do have one slight regret now that I think about it. The moderator, who was excellent, and those of you who might recall, Jacobi played the Master, and in his words, for only one episode. He was asked what his mother's maiden name was, to which he answered, Masters, just as the point of premonition, so to speak. And I really wish I jumped up and asked, was that the first or the second security question answer?
Nice. So how many Gallifreys have you been to now?
Probably four or five at this stage.
Jenny?
Yeah, I've been to three.
Hmm. Okay. And
not as many as you probably thought.
I didn't get to this one. I'm really hoping to get next year. I know there's cosplay. I know there's some sort of ball. I know there's panels. I know there's dealers' rooms. Mm-hmm. What else am I missing?
The area to go get autographs.
Oh, of course.
Also an area for videos if you want to go watch the, you know, the films and such themselves and the television series.
That's fun. Watching that with fellow fans, that's got to be a blast.
Eric, with that one.
There are panels that are not Doctor Who-centric that talk about other sci-fi TV shows or some real live events. Last year, I had an opportunity to sit in on a wonderful panel talking about probes to go out following the success of Voyager. And that was very easy to listen to.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was JPL giving the talk, I believe.
So since between the two of you, you've been to almost 10 of these things now, is there a favorite celebrity encounter you'd like to share?
Oh yes.
Gosh. Yes. Go ahead, Neil.
John Barrowman.
Captain Jack.
My wife, Lynn, her license plate was Torchwood, T-R-C-H-W-U-D. Now, John Barrowman got a hold of a TARDIS blue Tesla. I do believe it was a gift from Elon Musk. But I brought him the license plate to autograph it, and he just stared at it for a moment. And what's the policy of profanity on this show?
Say what you want.
Okay, well, I'll keep it mild. But this is a direct quote. He looked at me and said, so you're the bastards that got this place. He'd been trying to get it, and
Oh, my God.
And then to add insult to injury, I was asking him to autograph. But the best part, the next day I was walking down the passageway towards the dealer's room. He was coming out. We locked eyes, and he just went at me.
That is awesome.
Oh, that was the highlight of my day, being spat on by John Barrowman.
Oh, my God. And Barrowman is one of the most fun people at a convention. I got to see him at San Diego Comic-Con on the Sci-Fi Wired panel, and it was just – he just –
oh, he's a
– he was friggin' Squirrel Girl.
Yep, he was. That's right.
So.
I saw him in a little tiny panel, and I don't remember what the panel was, but it was somebody's birthday, this rather ordinary-looking middle-aged gentleman, and somehow John found out that it was his birthday, so he climbed down off the stage and full on the lips planted a birthday kiss. It was awesome.
Aww.
Very cool.
Next time it's going to be my birthday. I'm prepared to lie for that kind of thing.
I'm also glad to see I'm the only one that goes to Barham and Barham orbit.
All right. I should tell him that actually next time I see him. Jenny,
you
have
go.
You a celebrity encounter?
You know, I do, and sadly this person actually just recently passed away, but it was Michael Jaston, and he played the Vale Yard, but I also had remembered him from a BBC series that he did with he did back in 1973, before I was born, but I'd seen it on video. It was a four-part of Jane Eyre. And I walked up there, and I just was, you know, asking him questions about that. And, you know, he's just sitting there chatting away, wanting to know if I want to know anything about his time at the Old Vic or, you know, anything about Orson Welles. And I'm
cool.
just like, all right, he's talking. And, of course, this queue starts forming behind me because, of course, you know, we're supposed to have him sign a wee bit. And he's like, no, I'm busy. I'm talking. Like, okay, this is cool. But yeah, sadly, he passed away this year, or technically last year, 2023. So, but I did get his autograph, and I got to chat with him a bit about the Old Vic and his time there, and a little bit about both Orson Welles and Laurence Olivier. So that was quite fun.
That's cool. Lovely.
Yeah, like I could listen to this man for hours.
Is there any Doctor Who swag? As you know, I am a pack rat, so I have little Doctor Who figures. I've got Funko Pops. I've got autographed photos. I was even given a lovely gift of a pen made from an actual TARDIS. The wood on it was once one of the screen-used TARDISes. Do you have any... Oh, my God. I every now and then I look at it and just, it's so lovely. is there anything that is in your collection that you either got at Gallifrey One or somewhere else that you prize? And do you have any grails, anything that you're looking for?
Recently I just got... Alex Kingston to sign for me, and she wrote, you know, River Song on it as well. So that was kind of fun.
Excellent.
Today is her birthday, by the way. I just wanted to point that out.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, happy birthday to her then. Of course,
was it a photo you got autographed?
Yes, it was. I've got a few toys that you've given me over the years as well. So that's fun. Some of those things from, you know, the San Diego Comic-Con. Great. Oh, a couple of fun things. So a friend of mine went to what used to be HMV back in the day. They're kind of few and far between in Britain. Stood in a queue to get autographed a couple of DVDs that she had purchased for me as birthday presents from David Tennant. I have those things from, it was like 2008 or 2007, I think it was, when she did that. So that was quite a surprise when she sent those out from Britain when I, you know, first moved out here to America. So that was fun.
Thanks, Neil.
Well, I don't really have much swag. The Doctor Who collection is modest at best, but I am rather fond of the... pocket watch I picked up on the cheap at Gallifrey again with Gallifrey, and it was kind of looks like a Doctor's pocket watch from him he hid in 1913 from the family of blood. It needs a new
that's
battery.
That's cool.
But, I'm sure I'll get along with that. But
that is a fun
But you're speaking of swag, it reminds me of a comic shop that a young woman named Diana Doherty. If you listen, Diana, a long time no see. This is back in 2003, 2004. This comic shop was on Pico Boulevard, down the road from Fox. If you remember the comic shop from The Simpsons?
Yeah.
Raining denies it. Everybody, literally everybody else on Earth says, no, that's the place. And patrons used to go there, compare a comic book guy to a fella that actually ran it. So the store got turned into a laundromat, I don't know how long ago, probably about 20 years ago. They opened it up as a British sci-fi shop,
basically very heavily focused on Doctor Who, Blake Seven, that kind of thing.
Blake Seven.
Only open for about 2 or 3 years, and I think, but I really do miss it, this popping down there. I'm so sorry.
That's a shame. But, yeah, I never got into Blake Seven. I really should. It's one of my my geek shame spots that I haven't watched any, just little scenes.
Oh.
But for British sci-fi, my big thing back in the day was Space 1999 to a little extent, and then UFO, made by Gary Anderson, who did Thunderbirds Are Go and all those wonderful puppetmation things. Loved that as a kid.
Until 90, I believe he did as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. What do you think, there's been an appreciable difference in doctors prior to Eccleston and Eccleston on? Has there been is he more violent? Is he more likely to use violence than, say, the old doctors, or is that just me?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Because remember, the doctor started with Eccleston. He was angry himself at what he had done, so he'd be lashing out and he'd have little patience. Tennant's doctor was more remorseful because he was absolutely appalled at the sight of guns. He was very anti-military.
Mm-hmm.
But still, he'd have his violent moments. He wasn't there to be checked by a companion. As for Matt Smith, I think he was more in total denial and sort of forcing himself to be happy.
That's interesting.
His incarnation took the time to count the population of Gallifrey before it went up in flames.
Yeah, good point.
So I think these doctors were going through the stages of grief in their own way.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. It's the 5 stages of grief.
Wow.
You look at anger, you look at denial, you look at bargaining. All of that is part of the stages of grief, and I think that's kind of what Russell T. Davies has been looking at and taking the doctor on that trip and the rest of us with him.
Well, there's a doctorate thesis waiting to be written.
I was going to say, that's a very astute observation.
Get a doctorate on a doctor.
A doctorate on Doctor Who, there you are.
TARDIS swag is the best swag. I just want to point that out. When it comes to collecting
I just
fun
wish the swag
stuff,
legs were bigger on the inside.
Yeah, I don't have much, but I have a water bottle that's a TARDIS. I also have a cookie jar that, when you open the lid, makes a TARDIS noise and it flashes the light.
That's so good.
Yeah, and I think I have a couple of like coffee mugs, like really nice ceramic ones from England. And I have that Pez dispenser I got from San Diego Comic Con. You remember I got a couple Pez dispensers?
Right.
Yeah. So from the official shop. So I absolutely adore TARDIS swag. Like, it's like my favorite. And even though the TARDIS itself may be kind of like British phone boxes, I mean, that is about as far apart from a millennial or a Gen Zer as you can get. Yet it's still here. We still love it. And I still will collect everything of it.
Right on. Okay. I have to go with the obvious.
Yeah.
I have to go with the obvious question. Do you have a favorite villain or monster?
Ooh.
I mean, we've got to talk about the Weeping Angels for one thing.
They're terrifying.
Those are definitely scary. And, of course, the Daleks. You've got to have those four.
Hell yes.
Well, I alluded to them earlier, and they're my current favorite because I'm actually on the Doctor Who binge right now, but I very much liked the Family of Blood I don't like to call them the villains. I like to call them the antagonists. Because their primary motivation, of course, they're talking about we'll take over everything and do the amazing and all that kind of thing, but they were trying to survive. They only had months to live. The doctor was their only source of nutrition, basically, to keep them going, and they're doing everything they could to survive. So at a certain level, they were justified in what they were doing. You can't fault them for that. Because, I mean, like the Daleks, I mean, they're just plain evil. The Cybermen, I mean, again, I don't want to say evil about the Cybermen, but they're driven by a directive to forcibly enslave and upgrade everybody. So they're more easy to
but they're
villains.
They think they're making
but they're a bit
things
more two
better.
Dimensional, I think, than I said to somebody like the Family of Blood, but that's just me.
Well, and the Family of Blood, look at the punishment they received from the Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
Versus what he goes out to the Daleks, or versus even the Cybermen. He's got sympathy in a way towards the Daleks and the Cybermen. I don't feel like he showed any sympathy for the Family of Blood.
No, he didn't.
Not even.
But then again, it's not the first time an antagonist or a villain Doctor who's been condemned to an immortality that they didn't particularly want. I seem to remember one. I think it was from the Colin Baker era where a fellow became immortal, but basically he was a living marble stone carved face in a mantelpiece or an altar or something.
Oh, yeah.
So it seems to be a recurring theme. Careful what you wish for.
That's not the first person that got turned into an immortal being in a strange option that looks like a curse more than a... Think of the face of Bo.
Yep, that's the first thing I went to when you said that.
Allowed to die.
Yes.
Although that's something I would love if they explored with the Shooty's Doctor, if we can get the whole story as to why John Barrowman became... Captain Jack became
Captain Jack, was it an
evolutionary thing, or did something artificial happen that ripped him of his immortality?
Yeah, we never actually learned that. He just had guesses about it, right? There's nothing canon.
We just got guesses. We got left hanging on that one.
Interesting. Have either of you explored Doctor Who in other media? Have you read the novels or the comic books or anything? And if so, is there anything you can recommend?
I just have a bunch of random comics. But other than that, in other media, no. Just some Red Nose Day spoofs like that. The Curse of the Fatal Death with Rowan Atkinson. But beyond that,
oh my God, we just had the anniversary of that. Jenny, can you?
Yeah.
Explain a little bit about Red Noses.
You mean like Red Nose Day?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so of course, you know, that's a charity organization where they do, fun, different and crazy things in order to earn a bit of money towards different charities. Usually it's children in need that tends to be the one. But, they do different proms for it and different little clips and shows that are often quite entertaining. The first one I, of course, think of is the one with Catherine Tate acting as Lauren Cooper getting a brand new Scottish teacher.
So you're not English then?
English, but, you know, he doesn't speak English. He speaks Scottish, and they're not in double Scottish. They're supposed to be in double English. So you can't understand a word he says. Tragic, you know?
And so the sketch involved a bunch of celebrities, including Rowan Atkinson, the brilliant Rowan Atkinson. Either of you want to tell about that?
Jenny, the floor is yours.
Yes, that one is, of course, the Curse of Fatal Death, which the Doctor gets to turn into various people in... And each time it's, we've got the 11th Doctor, the 10th Doctor, the 12th Doctor. But this, of course, predates, the current incarnation. But Rowan Atkinson was the 9th, Richard E. Grant's the 10th. I think Hugh Grant was in there someplace at the 12th. And then, of course, we get Joanna Lumley as the 13th Doctor. So,
hell yeah.
Brilliant. And you've got to be careful with those Dalek bumps, I'm telling you.
I don't know. Context is everything.
And it just...
So, in addition to having a brand new doctor, we also kept the old doctor. For the first time ever, they split. What do you think about that? What do you think about there being separate doctors going separate ways?
Well, you know, it's an interesting bit of fan service, really, for those who absolutely adore David Tennant. And don't get me wrong, I'm one of those that absolutely does love him as an actor. And yeah. I don't know what they're planning to do with it. It does create a little bit of a spanner in the works to some of the continuity. But the nice thing about Doctor Who is it's never bothered with continuity. So, you know, they might say one thing just to only take it back. So.
Well,
I guess we'll have to wait and see.
That is one thing where I do agree. I think it was Neil Gaiman who said it, that Doctor Who is by no means hard science fiction. It's more of a fairy tale. So looking at it through that lens, what we saw with the bi-generation is easier to. And also, nobody said it could never be done. I mean, the Doctor has a whole new set of regenerations, which to our knowledge, no other Time Lord had got. But...
No.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I loved it. They'll probably end up doing absolutely nothing with it. And if they don't, okay, fine. I mean, there's fertile ground there for beta canon novels, fan fiction, that kind of thing.
Mm.
But it occurs to me it might be considered a little bit superfluous since there's already a duplicate of David Tennant's Doctor fully human in an alternate universe that they might have been able to bring back somehow, although that may take us on a far more convoluted that...
but of course that's the meta crisis. The only problem with the meta crisis is he's only got one life, so he can't regenerate.
Yeah.
Mm. And
but,
you did mention Neil Gaiman.
Could.
Let's go.
And
what's her face? I can't believe I'm blanking on her name. Dr. Sarah Capaldi. Oh, jeez. Sorry,
you're talking about Clara? Are you talking about
the doctor, the first female doctor, not Joanna Lumley. I'm blanking on her name.
No, I'm pretty sure she came first with Joanne Lumley. But Jodie Whittaker.
Jodie Whittaker.
Jodie Whittaker.
Yes. Jodie Whittaker's
the 13th.
Doctor's regenerated into Susie and somehow they dragged in human David Tennant Doctor for the story. Could have worked. Something like he does have a lot of Donna's traits as part of it, so he might have been able to use that to continue the story, the adventure, that kind of thing.
Although Neil, since you mentioned
that wonderful line, I know.
I was going to say, since you mentioned Neil Gaiman, I wanted to drop in that one of my absolute favorite scripts is one of Neil Gaiman's Doctor Who episodes, The Doctor's Wife,
thought
could have easily been a two-parter, but I was happy with what we got. The buzz is that they're going to be doing something with the what we sometimes call the American Doctor or the Fox Channel Doctor Paul McGann, who Doctor Who fans know in the 90s, 1996, Fox did a Doctor Who in America, and this doctor rode a motorcycle and had stunts and kissed and was not really like other doctors, and I would like to touch on the whole doctor and companions thing, but what do you think about bringing Paul McGann into, because he certainly has not had a lot of love, it seems to me, on the British side.
Yeah, well, so, I think part of it's because they made that doctor part human, too.
Mm.
Yeah, but we can gloss over that.
I'm sorry, say that again?
You could probably gloss over that. I'm half human on my mother's side.
on your mother's side, huh?
Or whatever. he does,
but I think that he's done quite a few stories for Big Finish, too. And Big Finish does a lot of the Doctor Who extensions
right.
of the the Doctor Who world universe, whatever you want to call it. Mm. So I know he's done some of those.
Oh, since we saw the Doctor at the very beginning of that life, so to speak, and at the very end, regeneration. This was like 8 years ago, and the game has made that age further, so trying to do a series of flashbacks or whichever with him in between those years would be cumbersome to pull off. Yeah, I'd love to see it.
Hmm. They have been animating some of the found soundtracks of so-called lost episodes. Have you had a chance to see any of those?
I have one, yes. I don't know why, but I didn't find it as easy to watch as I might have. It almost seems as if the animation was a little bit too jumpy compared to other animated shows I've seen.
Okay.
It almost felt like, remember like when you were a kid and like you'd do these little doodles in the corner of a textbook and you'd flick all the pages really fast? Just seems like that in terms of its presentation.
Oh, dear.
Felt like one of those flip books, yeah?
Yeah, a little, kind of. I mean, I would just love it was just a little bit smoother than it is, but everybody's a critic, guys. I'm just glad they exist.
Mm.
Jenny, have you ever cosplayed at a convention?
I've not cosplayed at this one specifically. I have done things for Halloween. I did go as Missy 1 year for Halloween. That was kind of fun.
Oh, God, speaking of villains that you love. God,
yeah.
She chews.
Definitely.
You did the Peter Cushing one, too, which is fun.
Oh, I love doing that one. Although I keep meaning to get a proper gray mustache to stick in my face. I just never get around to it.
Why did you decide to do Peter Cushing, who most Whovians wouldn't even count as a doctor?
That was precisely why I did it. I was actually hoping to start a fight at Gallifrey One over the canonicity, and I was hugely disappointed because I'm slapping myself if I say this, I'm sure, but everybody seemed to love it.
Yeah, you wanted to be a mixer, and they all congratulated you on it. That was what was fun.
I was like, no, fight, please.
Every time
I resisted the urge to push people's Daleks, so I'm good there.
Yeah, that might be one reason why Peter Cushing isn't really counted in the canon, because he was able to fight Daleks by pushing them.
Yes, well,
goodness.
You know.
Goodness.
Although it would be wonderful somehow to stick him in, let's say, a flashback memory or TARDIS memory or something like that, just to rile up the fan base.
Well, speaking of out of the timeline and out of memory, I would love to bring up one of my favorite, easily in my top three favorite doctors, and see what your reaction is to the War Doctor.
Oh, John Hurt. Yeah, he's brilliant. Brilliant actor.
Yeah.
Marvelous.
I would have loved to have seen a bit more of that, but unfortunately he's not with us to do that anymore. So.
Mm-hmm.
That's a shame. But I do like the fights over how doctors are counted since the War Doctor. Like, is Exo the Ninth Doctor or the Tenth Doctor because there was the War Doctor? Aha.
Mm.
Yeah, that's become a... case of contention too, hasn't it?
Indeed.
A little bit.
Contention that I thoroughly enjoy and revel in, particularly when people want to say, no, he's not the doctor at all. He even said he wasn't the doctor and that kind of thing. I love those debates.
That's just what the Messiah would say.
Exactly.
Mm.
He is the doctor.
That's what I'm
saying.
He's
not the Doctor.
I'm
he's not, a naughty boy.
He's just a naughty Gallifreyan.
Exactly.
If you had to start somebody on Doctor Who, or someone came up to you and asked you, where should I begin, what would you counsel?
Depends on what I have access to. If I've got access to some of the BBC stuff, Tom Baker. If I've only got access to the most recent, Christopher Eccleston.
Nice.
I agree, although I would suggest, if I definitely start with Christopher Eccleston, but if I want to get a bit more rounded, watch at least one or two episodes of each other incarnation of the Doctor, just to get a slightly more rounded experience, so you can get a fuller flavor for the character, even if it's just clips on YouTube.
Is there any Doctor that you would say, yeah, you don't have to so much watch any of that? Or are they all good in their own ways?
Well, I know the favorite to pick on is Colin Baker's Doctor, but I think at that point the writing was a little bit suspect. And after meeting him as well, and he's an amazingly nice guy, I really don't want to do that.
No, the actor's quite fun to listen to, so he's quite a character.
Mm-hmm. And he's involved with other fandoms as well. I mean, he's done a Star Trek fan film as well, in Star Trek Continues.
Oh.
Along with the young woman who played Perry, his companion, I think she was in the same episode.
Oh, how about that?
Interesting.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. I've only the first Doctor has some issues. Not that he was bad, but they were doing a straight-up, like, time travel historical narratives in the first season. And I don't think those kind of hold up as well as the rest of the body of work, because once they started getting their idea of playing with the multiverse and time travels and loops, and it really took off and became its own thing. And I would say some of the older, really old ones do not hold up.
Well, I wonder, was that a way to get the BBC on board to fund this by convincing them, oh, it's going to be educational as well? And BBC were thinking, well, that'll get Parliament off our backs for a couple of weeks at least.
Yeah. With the money for the licensing.
And also, like, if you're focusing on historical things, well, you've got all of the BBC's existing sets for other historical periods that you can use, because it's a general understanding when you're pitching a science fiction show, most studios don't want to touch it because it's going to be expensive, because everything has to be built from scratch. You can't just borrow the Victorian set from Studio 4 or the Wild West set from Studio 5.
Well, and remember too that Britain 1963 was a very
had
different
no
world.
Money.
I mean, we were just coming out of Washington, for God's sake. So, you know.
You're still in Russian currents at that point,
I believe. Different money was very tight back in the day. I've heard my grandparents tell stories, so, you know.
Basically, for American audience, what you suffered during the Depression in the 1930s is basically what all of Europe suffered in the 50s and early
60s. 50s and 60s, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Especially those that
Absolutely.
Didn't take any master plan money, so, which Britain didn't, so, you know.
Since we are saying goodbye to Jodie Whittaker for the current moment, let's hope we see more of her, and we can now look at her run as the Doctor, the 13th. Where would you put her in the other Doctors if you were to list, and do you think the writing was less than what it could have been for her years?
Jenny, do you want to take that one first?
Oh, well, she's a great actor. I've liked her in a lot of other things. You know, I watched her when, you know, Broadchurch was on. There's definitely different things that I've seen her in. So she's a good actor. She knows what she's doing. I think some of the writing did a bit of a disservice to some of her character. And the fact that they started out with, you know, four people in that TARDIS gets a bit crowded. So it's hard to, you know, in a one-hour show, it's hard to give everybody sort of their time. And at the end of the day, the dynamic kind of is supposed to be the Doctor with the companion along for the ride, and now you've got a whole bunch of other people you're going to have to follow. So she's going to get less screen time, less air time.
Yeah.
And so I think some of that did a major disservice to her acting abilities. And, you know, she did great with what she had, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah, from the word go, she sold me as the Doctor. She seemed to take a lot of the best qualities from several previous Doctors, just cherry-picked, I like this, and brought that to the fore. First thing that comes to mind is, like, why are you calling me madam? Half an hour ago, I was a gray-haired Scotsman, and other reactions a little... you could definitely tell that now she's the Doctor, no question about it. As for the writing, I don't know what went wrong, because I can't help but wonder, did they unwittingly find themselves writing for the female Doctor, as opposed to, no, you're writing for the Doctor, and forget about who's playing the Doctor, you're writing for the Doctor. And there were more than a few episodes, unfortunately, where, to coin a phrase from John Champion's podcast, Mission Log, there's so many episodes that were kind of like, bonk, bonk on the head. Here's the message, people. Don't miss the message. Hey, you see the message right here? Like, yeah, we get it. It's supposed to be subtle. Move on. So I don't think that she had enough leeway to be the Doctor she could have been.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
No,
Natalie,
yeah, it certainly might.
I was going to say, Natalie says that she feels like they didn't put in their best effort because she was a woman. And I haven't seen enough of her run. I'm going back through, and we're currently with Peter Capaldi, and I'm just so enjoying those again. Peter Capaldi, I think, is so underrated as a Doctor. I was really happy to hear Neil say that he was a favorite of his. I'm definitely looking forward to watching Jodie's run, because I too really love her as an actor. So I'm looking forward to seeing the whole run and trying to put it in with all the other things that people have said. How do you two come down on the sillier Doctor side? Like with our new Doctor, we got the Goblin Song, which actually went top of the pops in the UK, which, can I just say for a moment how much I love and admire the UK for having a big, broad, silly music chart, unlike ours. Ours seems so homogenized, but over there, something like Shut Up Your Face back in the day could hit the top, and the Goblin Song in the top 10 in UK. Where do you guys come down on silly, fun, musical Doctors?
You know, I found that episode a lot of fun, but I'm the one that, you know, to me it was an homage to Labyrinth, and of course I absolutely adore Labyrinth and David Bowie, so, you know, that that ticked all the boxes for me, so that wasn't a concern or an issue, and I like the fact that the Doctor could sing. I mean, I think that's actually quite great, and it's not the first time that, you know, a science fiction show has done, you know, somebody singing, or even a horror show. I mean, I think of the Buffy episode where they did singing too. So, I mean, you know, it rings true, as it were. You know, it's definitely something that's within the scope. I don't know. What do you think, Neil?
Well, honestly, I'm not a fan of musical episodes. Didn't care for it in Buffy, didn't care for it in Strange New World. And yes, I know it's unpopular opinion. I mean, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, but my immediate reaction to that episode was the same as Bart and Lisa when Homer, trying to come up with a new Mr. Plow shtick, decides to do a rap, and they're like, stop that, don't ever do that again. Sorry. And I'm just hoping that the writers of Strange New World are listening. Please don't do another musical episode.
Oh, God. Goodness.
But as for it was just a piece of it, a paragraph rather than the whole story, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, okay, we have to do this to get through this. Okay, we can do it. Boom. Yay. Rather than the whole episode being musical. And the thing is, I don't dislike musicals, but
I like musicals that are set out from the beginning to be musicals rather than shoehorning it in, like I feel they did with Buffy and with Strange New Worlds. But I don't think they did that here, because, like I say, it was just a scene, not the whole episode.
Definitely.
Well, you and I disagree on the Strange New Worlds episode. I loved it. And
I switched off halfway through. I was like, okay, we're done.
You missed the K-pop, the Klingon boy band K-pop, dude. That's not right. And I want you both to know that Comic-Con every year has a sing-along for the Buffy episode Once More with Feeling. And
they do.
It rocks. It is magical. So there.
I'll bet it is. And I'm sure I'd love to engage in that sing-along. I just did not care for the episode. I suppose there's a limit to the flimsy that I enjoy. I don't know, or maybe I'm just an aging fuddy-duddy.
I just think it shows the talents of the actor at it, that they can do more than just whatever that particular, you know, that character calls for.
It shows as much as I criticize that episode of Strange New Worlds, some of them got fantastic voices altogether.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear. The young lady doing Uhura. Oh, my goodness. Give her a whole freaking episode doing that, and I'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Like I say, I'm not putting the performances or the actors, just the idea.
Okay, well, since we're coming down to the end here, going forward, we know that having a person of color as a doctor is going to upset a certain segment of the fandom, and since they are apparently going to be addressing issues of race in future episodes, let's get ahead of the curve. What are we going to say to our incel brethren when they freak out and they tell us that Doctor Who has gone woke?
It's the same thing, but they're screaming Star Trek have gone woke. When did this happen? Mm. September the 8th, 1966. Next question.
Exactly. It's like November 1963.
Here, here. Well said.
But you know something? I'll bet hard cash that it very likely didn't, when Shuti was announced as the Doctor, that it didn't ruffle a single feather in that way. Just speaking from experience, I remember when Deep Space Nine first came out, and I saw the first promotional poster, like the Star Trek magazine. This was like in 94, I think, or 93.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Four things. It was the picture like where they're in front of that burnt orange drapes, whatever it was, just showing. It just basically cast photo. Uh-huh. Four things came to mind. One, hey, Colomini's a series regular. That's brilliant. Two, those uniforms are amazing. Three, how the hell does a Ferengi fit into this? We suppose we'll find out. And four, really hope the kid is not Wesley Crusher 2.0. That's down to the writing, not the actor. Didn't even register about the captain's skin color or anything like that. Then I come over to America, and I learned years later that that was caused a huge ruckus. So I was like, why? You know, so it's just something I don't get, and I don't really understand why Shuti's casting would cause an upset. Although, having said that, one thing I will say, a Rwandan refugee who lost everything comes over to another country, parents working hard, and he's doing his thing, and now he's a national icon. I mean, that's the kind of success story that one
isn't
hears
that
about.
Yeah.
And fair play to him.
Come on.
No doubt.
So, yeah, I don't get it either. So.
Do either of you see an end to Doctor Who, or is this something that can continue basically forever?
I don't know. Isn't the Doctor supposed to be timeless?
Well, he was supposed to have a limited number of regenerations, but they kind of played with that, didn't they?
They did.
Never,
you
ever
know,
tell me the rules.
You're right, exactly.
Well, what I think is probably most likely to happen is at some point, hopefully not soon, it's
going to run out of steam. Interest will wane like it did in the 80s. It'll probably go on a hiatus for about 15, 20 years. Kick back off again with a new Doctor, similar TARDIS, and start the whole cycle again. And if that's the worst that happens, I can live with it.
That's exactly what I expected to do, too, because, I mean, it's too well-known of a story, and people like the character. They might get bored with what they're seeing, but people still come back to it. Because it's,
indeed, or they might drop out for one Doctor, come back to the next one.
Well, see, the next episode, we're going to have to bring you back and talk about spinoffs and Torchwood and everything else. I can't thank you both enough for coming on. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you. I enjoyed this.
I hope,
it was fun.
I hope you come on to talk about other geeky stuff with us in the future. I'm going to pass it back to the head hauntress. I think we were going to talk about upcoming things. You can hang up or you can listen in, and I will see you both soonly.
All right.
Aaron
down.
Said I could
to
hang
you
up. Neil is a free elf.
thank you for coming on the show and sharing your Doctor Who fandom, and maybe someday I'll get to Coda of Gallifrey with you.
Alright, good night.
Come on
everyone.
Over if you want to go to the guest bedroom, turn down.
Good night now.
Good night, stay safe.
Good night.
So great, so you had a couple of things that you wanted to do right before we closed up for the night. So go ahead and pitch your stuff, sir.
We've got so many cool things coming up. It's just ridiculous. Next week in Los Angeles and in New York, there are premieres for You Can Call Me Bill, the documentary about William Shatner. And,
oh, yeah.
The one here in L.A. is going to have Kevin Smith. It's going to be at the Culver Theater and the Culver Studios, depending on what level you purchase. And we're celebrating his, 93rd birthday with Bill? So if you want to spend the dough, you can have birthday cake and a birthday toast with Kevin Smith and William Shatner. Culver Studios is where they filmed the original Star Trek pilot with Captain Christopher Pike that became The Menagerie, and also the first pilot with William Shatner. Coming up Wednesday, March 20th at the Academy Museum, they're doing a showing of Showgirls in 35mm with Elizabeth Berkley and the Vice President of Publicity at Searchlight Pictures, Barry Dale Johnson, introducing the film. Next week is Natalie's spring break. I'm really working hard to talk her into this one.
That sounds like fun.
Doesn't it, though? Oh, my God. There are so many things I want to ask them. The fifth and final season of Star Trek Discovery premieres April 5th. So put that on your calendar for sure. Let's see. Tomorrow is 314 or 3.14 Pi Day. Look around you for all kinds of cool Pi specials, pizza, Marie calendars, whatever. The 17th, St. Patrick's Day, Sunday, there is a mutant meetup in Los Angeles at the Horror Fives Coffee. Fans of Joe Bob are all getting together to meet up.
Nice.
That kind of sounds like fun.
Yep, and Friday is the premiere of Joe Bob, so don't forget that.
Yes.
So
next Saturday, and I have tickets for this, at our favorite art house cinema, the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana, they are doing a screening of Victor Crowley.
Nice.
Pardon me. And our favorite mangled dick expert, Melissa Rose, is going to be there.
Oh, most excellent. Lots of things to look forward to in the future. And WonderCon is right around the corner.
Yep.
What days are those? That's April, right?
The Friday, Good Friday, the 29th, Saturday, the 30th,
and Easter Sunday the 31st.
And that's March or is that April?
That's the end of March, beginning of April.
Okay, so
and
it
then,
is coming up in 2 weeks.
Yeah, right up. Pardon me. And then let's see. The director of The Last Voyage of the Demeter and Troll Hunters is doing a signing at our favorite horror bookstore, Dark Delicacies in Burbank. That'll be Sunday the 24th.
And his name is Andre Orvidal, if you want to know.
That is correct. That's true. we actually got to meet him, Natalie and I, and talk with him, and he is a very, very cool dude.
He did.
And
Troll
then,
Hunter is my favorite found footage movie, like hands down.
Really?
Like, yeah,
I can see that. I can absolutely
yeah.
see that. And then the other thing that I'm really trying to talk Natalie into, on April 6th, Saturday, John Waters is at the Academy Museum of Motion Picture, and he's going to be talking for a good long while himself, and then he's going to introduce Pink Flamingos.
Nice. Excellent. And I can listen to him read a phone book. I highly recommend
right?
going to see him live. He's amazing. So
I'm Natalie.
Yeah, well, most of the next show is going to be devoted to our trip to WrestleMania and to the Total Eclipse of the Sun on the 27th. But I definitely think you should call in and do a quick half-hour preview of WonderCon on that episode.
Okay.
Is that cool with you?
I will put it on the calendar, the 27th,
yeah.
Wednesday.
27th,
yeah, you got it.
Yeah, so that will work for that. Don't forget, in 2 weeks, the Godzilla times Kong comes out. So, and yeah. If you go to the Circle K, they have the best cup swag for you know, go their swag for the promotion for the new Godzilla movie is
Circle
choice.
K.
So Circle K, yeah, look and there's hard to
nice.
Find, but yeah, look they're better than the Dune worms.
I love the Dune popcorn holder.
I did too, but you know, yes.
Have you seen
buttholes.
The Slimer popcorn bucket for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire?
No, but I've been hearing
it's
the
beautiful.
Early reviews, and it's getting really positive buzz in preview. So
very
I'm very happy for that film, actually, because I was going out of my way, but now I actually think I might want to see it. So I'm looking forward to that. So all
excellent.
That stuff's coming up, and we'll talk about that in 2 weeks on the 27th. Once again, that one will be mostly about WrestleMania weekend and GCW and all this wonderful stuff. But we're also going to do a preview of our trip to Niagara Falls and Total Eclipse of the Sun, and then we'll do a recap in a couple weeks after that. So we'll see you
excellent.
On the 27th. Aaron, thank your friends Lynn and Neil again, or Jenny and Neil again, for being on the show.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lauren, for calling in and giving him 2 cents on the Oscars. Thank you all for dealing with my coughs today, because I am a little under the weather. Everything happens at once. I am sick and also going through major life events, which is so on brand for me. So
aww.
We'll talk about but it's not bad things. But we'll
okay.
talk about that. I will definitely know more on the 27th about that stuff, and I might be able to make an announcement on that too. So you all have a good evening, good night now. We're going to leave you with the king himself, Godzilla minus one, which I still think should have been nominated for score, but you know, it's an adapted score. They don't give them out anymore, which is tragic because it's fantastic. So, but it did win score in Japan, 8 wins, including Best Picture.
What?
So congratulations to Godzilla Minus One and all the other Oscar winners. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. Good night. Blessed be. Good film hunting. Good night, everyone.
Good night.